This is KUOW's Week in Review. Welcome to Friday. I'm Bill Radke. We will be discussing the top stories of the week for the next 60 minutes, including Jesus and Satan at Bremerton High and a move to rebrand the Seattle Public Library and more. But first, this week you filled out your ballot, or you meant to fill out your ballot, or you felt good about having already filled out your ballot. Why does your vote matter? A Pulitzer Prize winner will tell you this hour. Stranger Associate Editor Eli Sanders, a Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter, Q13 Fox Political Analyst C.R. Douglas. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Hello. Morning.
Good to see you. Eli Sanders, what is most at stake in this election?
The balance of power on the Seattle City Council. We have an election where all 9 seats on the council are up. This is unusual. It's a result of our switch to district elections. And we have some very strong, quote-unquote, insurgent candidates running.
Why do you say insurgent?
Because they're trying to tip over the balance of power on the council, which they feel is tilted too much toward establishment groups, the Downtown Seattle Association, Vulcan, restaurant industry, people protecting the status quo. And so you have, for example, John Grant trying to, he's an outsider tenants' rights advocate trying to unseat the sitting Seattle City Council president, Tim Burgess. You have Shama Sawant, who is, I think, even though she's on the council, rightly considered an insurgent still, even by her council members, who effectively voted 6-2 the other day, not to say that they didn't want her on the council, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she's running. And
does that help her or hurt her?
I think it definitely helps with her base. That race, by the way, if we talk about individual races later, has gotten really interesting and pretty tense. The back and forth on KOW's debate that you guys put up recently was tough. But so Grant, Sawant, you've got Tammy Morales trying to unseat Bruce Harrell, who's been on the council for a long time. You've got Deborah Juarez up in the 5th District. There's not an incumbent there, but she's a rabble-rouser in her own right. You've got Michael Maddox in the 4th District. Gene Godden is out in that district, and Maddox is, I think, someone you could consider an insurgent, more progressive candidate. So have I named 5 yet? I think I have, and that's a council majority. Mm-hmm. And so if you get an outsider activist council majority, you are going to see a different Seattle City Council, which would be very exciting for a lot of people.
Sierra Douglas, is that also your top story, the rabble being roused in Seattle?
I do tend to agree that that is the biggest thing at stake here. Who would have thought just 2 years ago that Shama Sawant, who was this lone socialist elevated to the Seattle City Council, would be on the verge of a majority there? And if she gets to 5, it would be a huge deal. It would be a kind of an earthquake at City Hall. What you're seeing this year, and it relates to this, is the resurgence of slate politics, which we haven't seen in a generation in Seattle, maybe even 2 generations, where a band of candidates gets together and agrees to sort of run on the same agenda. We typically are kind of a, you know, everyone on their own type of city when we run for city races, but banding together and saying, hey, we're moving an agenda. I mean, just this week you saw at City Hall, 4 of these progressive candidates were talking about, you know, progressive taxation if they get elected. A couple weeks before that, they were talking about housing affordability proposals they were going to push. So, and this is all being driven by Shama Sawant. She is really pushing to get a majority in that council, and, you know, she could do it. Still an uphill battle. She's not a for sure, and not all these races are for sure, but that's the thing to watch this year, I do believe.
So most at stake, an insurgent, uber-progressive agenda on Seattle City Council. Joni Balter, what's most at stake in this election?
So this is a battle between old Seattle and new Seattle. And you're seeing it here, you know, who would be more powerful on the council. But think about the relationship as well with the mayor. So you're Mayor Ed Murray, and you get up the day after the election. And if Tim Burgess loses, really, is the pivotal point on that. And Shama Sawant has 5 votes for what she wants. I don't know how the mayor calls her up and says, hi, co-mayor, what do you want to do this week? Or how are we going to work this?
Mm-hmm.
The whole district election thing is, it's an earthquake, as CR said, but I'm not sure it's such a great one. I mean, one of the ideas, actually the idea behind this for the folks who were paying for it, was to get somebody a little bit more moderate or a conservative on the council. Everyone loves to talk about diversity. What about ideological diversity? We're going to have, you know, and the whole thing, love the stranger some days and maybe not on some others, but the whole idea is, you know, less experience, more rabble rouse. Really? You know, cover your ears, folks, but I think it's a good thing to know something about the city and to know, you know, the issues. We had three incumbents step down for, you know, as soon as districts became clear, step down. That's a lot of experience. Does everyone think inexperience is kind of a good crusading point? Because I don't.
Let's so the strangers, Eli Sanders, you're against experience and diversity.
No.
Yes?
So, you know,
fair?
My friend Joni Balter is saying that the stranger has endorsed inexperienced rabble-rousers. Well, let's look at who we endorsed. In District 1, that's West Seattle, we're endorsing Lisa Herbold. She has been on the city council in a sense, almost as long as Nick Licata. She's a longtime aide to Nick Licata. She's responsible for a lot of the legislation that he puts forward, a lot of the progressive moves that he's made. You cannot call her inexperienced. Tammy Morales, she has less experience than other candidates, but she has been involved in her community. Shama Sawant in District 3, she is a sitting council member. I think that counts for some experience. Michael Maddox, he's on the Parks Board.
Shama Sawant is usually standing
in electoral politics at a local level in Seattle for a very long time. That's a lot of experience. Mike O'Brien, sitting council member, that's experience. Sally Bagshaw, experienced. John Grant ran the tenants union. That's a fair amount of experience. And Lorena Gonzalez worked for the mayor. So there's our nine endorsements. I don't see a bunch of inexperienced rabble-rousers. The issue is more an ideological divide and who is going to push more to the progressive left.
Why is this happening in Seattle now, this old versus new? Is it just the new money coming in? Well, you tell me. Why is, if Joni's right, that that's what this election is about to her, why is this happening right now? And is it really happening, or is it just, well, you know, sort of like, what's your... Is this real, or is this just some individual politicians who happen to have made it this far?
I think it is real. I mean, the city is moving left. Mayor Murray is more liberal than Mayor McGinn was, who was more liberal than Mayor Nichols was, who was more liberal than Mayor Rice was. The trend is pretty clear. But I do think districts is accelerating this phenomenon. You have candidates who are achieving success under this new system in these smaller geographies that would not have had the same success running citywide. It's tougher to man a citywide campaign.
So it's not just boom times in Seattle and affordability and all the stuff we talk about. It's the mechanics of the way we're doing the elections.
Like I said, I think Seattle's moving in that direction, but I think there is a sort of backlash to growth. But there's also, yes, the mechanics of districts is accelerating this move to progressivism.
Which you're saying, Joni, was the opposite of what we were supposed to expect. At least the backers of districts were saying, hey, we're going to get some more neighborhood-focused.
They wanted more moderates. They wanted was moderates and even like a guy, this name might not mean something to everybody, but like a Paul Krobel, a moderate Republican. They wanted ideological diversity, which this race is not really bringing. And I want to address the growth thing. So one of the things that's going on here is this city is enduring one of its big, as everybody knows, big growth spurts. And in growth spurts, people really, you know, they need people who can help them through it because there's so much change. There's, you know, folks, let me just speak for the older Seattle folks who, you know, they didn't do anything. And all of a sudden in the summer, the idea was we'll upzone the single family neighborhoods. Now, the mayor choked that one back, which was a good idea if you think of it. But it's just this tension. If you drive a car, you're bad people.
Let's talk about districts for a second. We were wondering what the motivation was. I think we should point out that districts was funded in part by Faye Garneau. Does that name sound familiar? She's the, you know, Republican boogie person that is being brought forward in terms of the money that she's put in against Proposition 1 in Seattle. That's the Move Seattle Forward levy.
So, what's wrong with her putting money behind her opinions about a
there's
levy?
There's nothing wrong with it, but I just want to point out that when we're talking about the motivations for districts, I think some Republicans thought that this might give them a fighting chance in, you know, smaller geographical areas. That was also a motivation behind districts. And another one was races will cost less. We will have less influence on money in politics, and that has certainly been disproven this year. We've got more money being spent in the form of independent expenditures in this council election than any council election since they began tracking those expenditures.
Why did it turn out that way?
Well, I have actually a different view on that because I think districts has lowered the bar to becoming a viable candidate in terms of money. I mean, you've seen these candidates we're talking about, Lisa Herbold, Michael Maddox. They've raised a lot less than you had to raise under an at-large system to become viable and to certainly get through a primary. Yes, you're seeing a lot of outside money, but outside money tends to come in late, and it's meant to be kind of the final boost to push you over the end line. Outside money cannot create a candidate out of whole cloth, right? You can only do that yourself. To become viable, you have to be the candidate with your own campaign committee. That you go to forums, you do the debates, you stand out in front of Safeway, you hand out literature, you mail some of your own flyers. Until you get to that level of viability, independent expenditures almost never come your way, and they don't typically help you. So there's a lot of outside money, but it's late money going to candidates that already became viable on their own at a lower price threshold because of districts.
In the narrow slicing, and the CR is right on this, because for a candidate to run a citywide, a district-wide campaign, it's now about, say, $50,000 to $150,000 for that candidate. In the old days, you pretty much couldn't get anywhere without that candidate spending about $250,000 to run citywide.
So, but does money, the lower money bar allow you to be viable, and then money crushes you in the general election anyway?
Well, we'll find that out in a number of races. Take the Bank Sawant race. We have independent expenditures coming in, and actually on both sides, which is pretty interesting. But there's a late independent expenditure that's shown up for Pamela Banks, who is seen as the more downtown-connected, mayor-connected establishment candidate. She got into this really tense back and forth that I was alluding to earlier with Sawant on your debate, where Banks is now saying that Sawant is not from here. She's playing a kind of, I'm not sure what the card is, nativist card against Sawant, who...
Well, that's how Sawant portrays it. She was just saying not from here, meaning that you haven't been a community organizer, an urban league president, lived in this district for 20 years. I raised a child in this district. She took offense to Shama Sawant suggesting that was some kind of nativist or anti-immigrant implication.
But that
could be heard that way. I really think it could be heard that way. And politicians, you know, think about the double hearings that are possible in their statements. But just to come back to the independent expenditures. So there's a really interesting thing going on where Banks has an independent expenditure behind her that can be linked to some Republicans. And of course, Sawant has been making a loud noise about it. Banks did something interesting. She said, you know what, I can't control independent expenditures. And in fact, I condemn them. And I want you, Sawant, to condemn independent expenditures too, because Sawant has independent expenditure money back from labor unions and so on. And Sawant's reply was, well, my independent expenditure is okay because the money's from the people. Yours is from the powerful. And so there's these interesting contortions that candidates, and you can find this phenomenon in a lot of other districts, have had to go through to simultaneously decry the influence of money in politics, but say their money is more okay than someone else's.
Two quick points. In the 5th District, Juarez has a lot of out-of-district, out-of-city money. And also, this argument that you're from outside Seattle, oh, come on, half the city's from somewhere else. I don't know that that plays.
Okay, let's pause it there. We've been trying to figure out what is most at stake as you're either eyeing your ballot and saying, I really ought to get around to that, or maybe you've voted and you're watching and waiting, just like we are. My what's most at stake question, the general answer, you all went to Seattle. What's going to come of these district elections, and are we going to have an insurgent, very progressive majority that our mayor is going to be waking up to along with the rest of us? Again, you've got till Tuesday night, 8 o'clock. Get your ballot in. Postmark it by November 3rd. Drop box it. Run to the van and drop it off by 8 p.m. on Tuesday. Back with KUOW's Week in Review, the reversal on the public library rebranding in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review, discussing, learning from, smartening you up about the news of the week. I'm Bill Radke. This week, the Seattle Public Library decided not to change its name and not to change its logo, which doesn't seem like a big deal. But for some reason, the very idea of this rebranding effort and the money spent on it offended a lot of library users. What is behind that reaction? What do we want our library system to be that maybe it's not living up to? Let's argue about that. Eli Sanders, first, why the anger over a rebranding?
Well, The Stranger was at the forefront of covering this. I think we broke the news in part of the cost of this rebranding, which was $2 million. So that's a lot of money. And what was it being spent on? Really, when you boil it down, the question was whether to add an S to Seattle Public Library and make it Seattle Public Libraries and pay a lot of money to for new signs and new business cards. And
with a new logo.
A new brand identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'll talk about myself. For me, when a company or an organization or a civic institution is trying to do a rebrand like that, it often connects to a bigger core problem that they can't solve and they're trying to paper over. And I would rather them address that with $2 million. I think the core kind of existential crisis for any library right now is people's relationship to the book. Our relationship to the book as an object is changing. And you might, you know, in the future have a public library filled with tablets instead of, you know, tablets like actual iPad-like tablets rather than books. And so that and all the cultural changes that go with it, the library kind of doesn't know what it's for anymore. In fact, Cool House designed the downtown public library as this kind of empty hangar-like space where you could, if you needed to someday, he saw the changes that were coming, move out all the bookshelves and put something else in if a library became something else. But anyway, if a library is becoming something else, put some money into what kind of interesting things it might become, more of a civic engagement space. I don't know. But, you know, $2 million is a lot to burn up on just adding an S to library.
Okay, you have loaded a lot of meaning into this rebranding idea, and I want to figure out why it is that people took changing the name. They say, so first of all, instead of the Seattle Public Library, it's Seattle Public Libraries. Seems kind of simple. You know, there's more than one library, and we're a network. You want to remind people there's a bunch, and if it's not at this branch, it's that branch, and all that kind of stuff. The logo goes from a book into there's a few different designs. We can talk about that kind of thing. And then the mission statement, the branding statement is, the library provides access to knowledge, experiences, and learning for all. We preserve and create opportunities for the people of Seattle who make it such a dynamic and desirable place to live. When we're empowered as individuals, we become stronger together. So you could look at that whole package as being, whether you think it's too expensive or not, you could look at it as being kind of inoffensive, or you can load it up with a theory that the library doesn't know what it wants to be.
I don't want to hog the microphone on this, but I just want to add something more than theory. Didn't we vote just a couple of years ago on giving the library more money because it was having to cut hours, cut access? So it's not just abstract theories about what a library should be. It's in the context of, you know, we need money just to keep core services going. They're blowing $2 million on business cards.
The outrage was mostly about money. I mean, very expensive, as Eli points out. I don't think a rebranding effort would have been automatically shut down. I mean, if you had done it differently and you had sort of engaged your library patrons into a competition about a new logo, that would have been pretty interesting. Maybe a competition about a mission statement. But this idea, this corporate idea where you hire this expensive outside marketing firm to do all these high-level brandings was very rejected. And I have to say one thing. Is there an institution in Seattle that is less in need of rebranding than the Seattle Public Library?
I
mean, look at the goodwill Seattle Public Library has. Probably no institution ranks as high, right? We love these neighborhood libraries. People love the Rem Cool House situation. They vote for all these levies. I mean, why are you messing with the brand of Seattle Public Library anyway?
And it is not an empty space. Go into the downtown library on any day. It is full of people.
Two words here, say wah. Does anybody remember? Does anybody
yes.
remember the 2006 campaign? It was $442,000. I looked it up. to rebrand the tourism effort here. It was the biggest bust in naming than, you know, in all time or something like that. Not to get into too much hyperbole here, but honestly, so they went around and they used the postal code for Washington, WAH, and said, oh, okay, here's how to bring people to Washington. I mean, they were coming anyway, and we really needed to spend that much money to get to say WAH, which everyone just laughed at. So this is this is in the same neighborhood, this campaign. It is a branding effort that is basically unnecessary. The library has so much cachet, and this whole idea that they have to tell people it's different in there is silly. Walk in there. Walk into any level you want to, and there are computers everywhere. Computers. They are making the forward transition, and people know that. They don't need to be told in a sort of a dumb campaign like this. This is strike one. This is what it is. Strike one against this effort.
One more thing. It feels like new person syndrome. You know, we have this new librarian that was installed a couple years ago, and it feels like, you know, to kind of justify themselves, they need to go through this. The other thing to say is, if you feel like you want to do a rebranding and you're kind of a nonprofit, basically, well, you don't hire these big outside firms. You have a retreat with your board. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go away for a weekend and you sort of look over mission statements and that kind of stuff. The outside firm is really what the pushback
is. That's when you do the color your personality thing. You do that right after that and before the donuts.
And Joni was talking about strike one. This is actually strike five in the sense that the Library Board of Trustees voted on Wednesday 5-0 to halt this rebranding effort because of the backlash.
First of all, I'll point out that your opinion that the Seattle Public Library has plenty of cachet and customers, everybody knows about the library. I'm talking with three Seattle, I don't know how old any of you are, but...
Bookish nerds,
journalists.
Married to an author, right?
I don't know whether the public library connects with the people of Seattle of all across the board as much as you think it does. I don't know.
When was the last time you walked into the downtown library during the day?
Probably 4 months ago.
So it's full. I imagine it was then.
It was,
people
yeah.
who are not... us.
Yeah, that's true.
They are not bookish nerds. They are, like Joni said, they're accessing computers for free, which they need.
Yes. Let me pose this. Could it be that this is a lot about a cultural divide that we're talking a lot about these days, that we're real and organic and love old-fashioned paper books, and you are corporate and digital and soulless? And it's another part of the tension we're feeling about old Seattle and new corporates, yeah.
Not buying that version of it. I would buy a different version of that.
And old and young, by the way, as well.
No, because the libraries are very digital and very tech. Just go in there, and the building's like one of the coolest buildings in the whole city, so people stroll by just to look at that.
People who love loud libraries.
Okay.
Wait, what is the old and young clash that you're seeing here?
You went right to it, that the Seattle Public, and I've read this before, that libraries have gotten away from the being sacred temples of the book, and they want to get all digitally. Like one of the new logos kind of looks like fiber optic cables to me with lights at the end, you know, as opposed to the book logo. I think there's some resentment about...
So that the reservoir of goodwill you're saying is actually drying up for the library because older Seattleites feel like it's moving away from them?
Well, I've heard this meme that libraries don't appreciate the book. They want to be all tablety and gadgety.
I think
and
it's
I think
all
that's
and.
An old young.
I think
division.
they're the book plus the digital. It's and. It's never been subtract one.
Yeah, the library's not saying nothing in their branding statement says goodbye book.
Things are going to change, and the library is looking at some trends that worry them a bit. I mean, attendance has been down. Book checkout has been down. I mean, that's partly because people are doing more from home via the library website. And also the digital downloads and digital, you know, people are using the library a little bit differently than just raw book checkouts. But that's great. You know, think about your trends and worry about what that's going to do to your library over 5 years. But it just doesn't strike me that you need a whole rebranding effort.
Okay. You were talking about our bias, you know, a bias we might have. Like the library, all of us are in a business that right now is trying to bridge the digital and the, you know, paper or old school divide, particularly newspapers like The Stranger and the Seattle Times, where Joni used to work. And that is, like Joni and CR were saying, and. You've just got to do more and more and more. And like David Boardman, the former editor at the Seattle Times, used to say, you can't do more with less. Less is less. So in that kind of context, when you're blowing $2 million on kind of nothing, when you could be using it to add to those numbers of ands that the library is doing, book programming, technology programming, bringing people into the library for all kinds of events, it just seems wasteful.
Okay, we got to check out here. Again, the Seattle Public Library. By the way, we
that
invited...
We in- good.
Thank you, Joni. We invited the public library, the librarian, the board to come on the show and talk about it, and they don't want to talk about it. They did decide not to to go ahead with this rebranding project for now, anyway.
That's like repeating say what. Okay.
Okay. Coming up, why doesn't the Bremerton football coach just pray in private like Jesus said? That's coming up in about 20 minutes. Q13's C.R. Douglas, The Strangers, Eli Sanders, and Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, and you learning from what happened this week. I'm Bill Radke. Would you like to reduce illegal poaching of elephants and rhinos and sharks and pangolins? Do you know how to do that? One idea is to vote for Washington State Initiative 1401 now on your ballot. It would make it a crime to buy or sell stuff made out of parts of some endangered animals. Supporting the initiative is Jennifer Hillman with the Seattle-based Humane Society of the United States. Opposing the initiative is former Democratic State Senator Stuart Halson with the Legal Ivory Rights Coalition Committee. Stu Halson, what is wrong with drying up the market for poached animals?
This initiative is targeted at antiques and only targeted at antiques. What this does is to reduce the demand. They're going back and they're eliminating the grandfathering in of antiques that were acquired legally 30, 50, 100, 200 years ago and making those illegal to sell or buy. For an antique to be exempt, it would have to be less than 15% ivory, more than 100 years old, and you would have to have the paperwork to prove provenance. I have a dice cup in my collection that is ivory. It was made 240 years ago. I don't have the paperwork to prove when it was made. Plus, it's all ivory. So that rather small $400 investment in an antique that I made would be gone completely.
Jennifer, who can prove that their furniture is 100 years old and legal?
Well, if it's a bona fide antique, oftentimes it does have documentation. But the issue here, Bill, is that these items can retain their inherent intrinsic value. You can will them to your heirs. What it does is take the market value out. We don't currently have a law that protects the intrastate sale, transport, possession of these products. So the federal law protects us from the outside of Washington State, but not within Washington State.
You know, I think you're talking, we're starting to say what I do. This is an asset that was acquired legally, was not in any way violating of international treaties or federal laws. And there are, in fact, laws on the books in the state of Washington that prohibit the interstate trafficking of illegal new ivory, but not to take that to the extreme and make the buying and selling of antique vintage ivory, whether it be a chess set, Mahjong tiles, dominoes, poker chips, things that have been around for hundreds of years, that's what they're targeting.
Jennifer, you say you can pass this stuff on in your will, but what about the property rights of people who bought their ivory legally and suddenly it's financially worthless?
As I said, you can still possess the items. They hold their inherent value. The demand that exists on the market, and the U.S. is the second largest market for these products. If there's any indication that poachers can still get money for these items, and you can't tell the difference between, you know, something that's 20 years old oftentimes and something that's older. So we had to draw the line somewhere. The animals are endangered. These are iconic species, 10 iconic species that voters around the country have told us overwhelmingly already they want to do something to help protect. And this is the way that we've been told we'll do that, is we have to remove that monetary value from just these products.
Stu, how many dollars worth of ivory do you have?
I've got about 7 pieces. Jennifer's seen them when we've debated each other. You know, it's a small part of my historical antique collection. Probably it's worth about $1,000 at most, and that's historical value, not the value of the raw ivory, which is actually quite minimal. But, you know, I've done well in life. I'm 63, and I have no worries about retirement. But $1,000 to me, with equivalent to what Paul Allen's wealth is, would be $10 million to him. And I'll tell you, if one of his Renoirs that he has hanging in his house on Mercer Island, he would be told that that's worthless now, I think he'd howl too.
I mean, Paul Allen is only one of thousands and thousands of voters, not only in Washington State, but around the country, that are really concerned about the fact that these animals could become extinct in our lifetime. And I think people, including Paul Allen, really care about that. And now that we know that the way to address that is through this market value on these products, we really do feel like we have to make the choice to protect these species.
Jennifer Hillman with the Seattle-based Humane Society of the United States advising you to vote for Washington Initiative 1401. Opposing it was Stu Halson with the Legal Ivory Rights Coalition Committee, referencing Paul Allen's Renoirs hanging on Mercer Island. Does anybody hear liberals complain about big money in politics if it's Paul Allen spending $3 million for elephants?
This is exactly what I want to say. I'm going to offer you a liberal complaint. So, of course, the stranger endorsed 1401 were for protecting elephants and pangolins and so on, who would want to harm them. However, Paul Allen is essentially showing with this initiative that he can do what Tim Iman does. He put $3 million of his own money behind this thing, and it's on the ballot, and now we're voting on it. Okay, Paul. We would also like you to get involved at the state level then in reversing some of the damage that Iman's initiatives have done over the year in terms of loss of state revenue. Our proposal to him in our endorsements was, okay, we're giving you a vote yes on this, but could you run an initiative next year that would find a source of revenue for our unconstitutionally underfunded public schools? That's our challenge to him and his millions.
So I would say, following along the whole Paul Allen thing, this is a boutique rich man's thing, but it's a good boutique rich man's thing. You know, Washington in some ways is becoming the new California. What I mean by that is about the sort of petri dish laboratory, new ideas come here. This is, you know, when folks thought about this, they probably said, try it in Washington, it'll probably pass, because we do approve a lot of things that other states won't, like Initiative 594, background checks statewide. That was notable. You know, these species are in trouble. This thing is going to pass, I'm fairly certain. You know, I don't know that you, maybe you should call Paul Allen if you want to tell him what to support or lead the way on next year.
We talked to his the people working for him on this campaign when they came in for our endorsement meeting. We wish Paul would.
So
have
So you
come
can
in.
Maybe
have
that meeting. People have those meetings all the time. And to the caller, Renoirs in houses, plural, on Mercer Island. I think there's 11 buildings there.
By the way, we invite KOW invited Paul Allen on to talk about this. He did not respond because I just now said it, and so it's only like 10 seconds has passed.
Oh.
But we'll keep you posted.
Yeah.
I think it'll pass. It's an animal-friendly state, but I don't think it'll make much difference. I mean, there's hardly any market for this stuff in Washington and illegal stuff coming through Washington. But it is about a larger movement. I mean, they are trying to kind of generate a state at a time and maybe get the feds to be cracking down on this harder. I do have some sympathy for the folks with antiques and other things. I mean, the only argument for outlawing things that have been around forever and that were, you know, possessed legally is that you can't really tell them apart from the new stuff. I mean, an existing ivory jewelry set that was, you know, done 50 years ago, that's not having any effect on current animal poaching, right? It's the new poaching and the new products. And the people of 1401 are saying, well, it's hard to tell the difference between those, so we're just going to have to outlaw everything. That feels not a great answer.
Couldn't we carbon date this stuff?
Feels like they should be able to outlaw the current influx of the illegal products and not have that mixed up with stuff that already exists.
I thought you were going to say you had some sympathy for the elephants, rhinos, and pangolins.
I do have sympathy for them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
One of the thing that makes it so you can't sell your ivory is that it has to be, you can't sell it if it's less than 100 years old or if it is more than 15% ivory. So if you have a piece of ivory, couldn't you just encase it in a big wooden frame. So now your piece overall is only 14% ivory.
Always looking for the loophole, Bill.
Thank you. Again, that's Initiative 1401. You heard the pro and the con. Look on your ballot. Have you looked on your ballot? Is it just sitting there? Because it's there on your ballot if you're a Washington State voter.
There's
Tuesday,
also an
8 p.m. Yes, sir.
Sorry, quickly. There's also an exhibit at the Woodland Park Zoo of things made from what would be these banned animal pieces. And it sounds kind of interesting. I was trying to pull up the photos, but it's like, you know, a cap lined with lion fur. Just kind of odd-looking animal-made objects that people already have, but that the zoo is trying to show you are kind of grotesque and that you don't need.
Wow, the zoo. I'm trying to picture which building they put that in. They're going beyond the cages and having a little educational exhibit.
Yeah, they're calling it an exhibit of extinction economy products.
How about that? KOW's Week in Review, football prayer coming up as we continue the program. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, the Bremerton School District put a Christian high school football coach on paid leave for openly praying in the stadium after the games. Coach Joe Kennedy started out praying alone a few years ago, but eventually he would be joined by players, fans, other coaches in a sort of informal prayer circle. The school district told him, "You can't make public religious displays like that. It's illegal. Knock it off." Kennedy kept on praying. His lawyers say his prayers most certainly are legal and that they'll defend his religious freedom. One of those lawyers is Jeremy Dice with the Texas-based Liberty Institute. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why doesn't Coach Kennedy just pray privately?
Well, he's not required to go somewhere out of public view. What the Founding Fathers put in place here in our country was the freedom to exercise one's religion. And that does not mean that the school district gets to push him around and tell him where he can and cannot exercise his religious beliefs. It is illegal for a school district funded by taxpayer dollars to tell their employees that they may engage in no public displays of religion. Think about the logic there for a second. If that is the case, then people who want to wear their yarmulke to work as a part of their faith, or if they care to wear a head covering as a part of their faith to work, wouldn't be disallowed. A Catholic teacher could not wear her crucifix around her neck. Or perhaps, if we want to get totally bizarre here, it would be logical that if someone sneezed in the hallway and a teacher dared say, "God bless you," that teacher could be punished. That's not freedom, and it's not what the Founding Fathers had in mind for our country.
The Bremerton High School District says that the courts have held repeatedly that a public administrator and authority figure praying with students participating in a school activity amounts to a government endorsement.
That's just not true. And we've asked for various accommodations, even if it were to be the case. The school district here holds all the cards. If they wanted to make this a case of private speech, which we think it is, they could very easily distinguish his speech from government speech by just simply announcing over the loudspeaker that Coach Kennedy is not speaking on behalf of the government. It's a very simple solution. But thus far, they've been not willing to give him that very reasonable accommodation. Instead, they have disciplined him by suspending him, and they're going to have the law now applied to them.
I was talking with Jeremy Dice, Texas-based Liberty Institute attorney now for Joe Kennedy from Bremerton High School. Jeremy, you're a Christian yourself. What does it mean to you when the New Testament has Jesus saying, "Go pray in your room, shut the door, pray to your Father in secret"?
Well, my personal beliefs aren't an issue here right now. What's at issue is the rights of religious liberty for every single American in this country, Coach Kennedy on down. And I think most every American, and those, including those listening to your show today, understand that if we lose our first freedom of religious liberty, it is very quickly to follow that we will lose many more of our liberties here. The government does not have control over where we can and cannot practice our religion. That is something that has been given to us in the First Amendment of the Constitution, and they need in Bremerton to recognize the freedom of religion that Coach Kennedy has while he's at work. And if we allow the dangerous precedent to be set that no public displays of religion are permitted, that at the job site, how long before that is applied to many other people at work today? That's not freedom. That's not what the Founding Fathers have put in place. Instead, they asked for and provided to us the full freedom of religion to live, to work, and do business according to one's faith.
The Founding Fathers also enshrined the separation of church and state, and I think you're confusing two things, a private company versus a public-funded institution like a school. And then I also have a question. You know, a lot of times we hear from religious conservatives when people get concerned about something that's going on in, say, Texas. The religious conservatives in Texas will say, mind your own business. This is a local issue. Don't come in from outside and tell us what to do. And here we have Washington State locally resolving its own issue and someone from Texas coming in and telling Washington residents how we should do things. How does that connect with the conservative idea of local control?
Well, I think the local control is pretty clear here. This whole thing started with a compliment. There were parents in the area that really appreciated what Coach Kennedy was doing, and they dared breathe utter a word of that to the school district, and now they're disciplining him for engaging in his religious beliefs while at work. And if you look at the game last night when they were there, the coach did not go on the field because he was not allowed to go on the field, but the members of the community there in Bremerton came around him to show their support of him. And I think that's what most Americans believe as well. This is not a problem. In our country, we have long valued public displays of religion. Now the Bremerton School District is telling us that's illegal. They're wrong.
Well, I'm thinking this is a huge overreaction on the part of the Bremerton School District. This is sort of spontaneous prayer. It's not required. There's no penalty for not engaging in it. I agree that you cannot establish a religion, but nobody's establishing a religion. This is prayer breaking out. It just seems like everybody's overreacting. Now you have this satanic folks over there. I mean, you know, this is just, it's going kind of wacko over there, it seems like to me. It needs to be brought down. On the other side of that, as a non-Christian person, it does give me a headache that we're always fighting this same thing with sort of these Christian expressions of religion at all times. It gets to be a little much for folks who are not.
Oh, look, we're looking at a lot of different fronts here with religious liberty, whether that is for Coach Kennedy here or Dr. Eric Walsh being fired from his job in Atlanta for simply preaching in his own sermon as a lay minister in his own Seventh-day Adventist church, whether it's the congregation here in Dallas of Orthodox Jews who were kicked out of their homeowners association for simply having a weekly meeting in their own neighborhood, or whether it's the Native Americans as trying to establish a sweat lodge at their local Veterans Administration hospital that we represent as well. A religious liberty for one person is religious liberty for everybody. And the fundamental part of all of this is freedom. If we're going to say, if we're going to allow the government to dictate where you can and cannot exercise your religious beliefs in contravention of the First Amendment, then we're pretty soon going to be having to be forced to listen to what government says as to where we are permitted to do our religious exercise. That's what the Founding Fathers were reacting against.
It seems to me that there's a difference between the individual display of religion, be it a rosary around your neck or a yarmulke, and a public prayer. And that's the difference here, is that this coach was engaging in a public prayer right after the game, in some cases encouraging others to participate, certainly player to participate. But
that's just incorrect. That's incorrect. Coach Kennedy has never once invited his players to come. In fact, back in 2008 when this started, after his...
He's never invited coaches of the other team to come?
Has he ever... His players started to ask him about it, and he said, look, you guys do what you want. It's a free country.
Well, even if that is the case, you cannot have a public prayer if people are sort of coordinating around you. I mean, even if he's not in a loudspeaker getting people to come, and the district claims he has been inviting people to do it. But that's still a public prayer if students are sort of becoming a part of it.
And why not do it off-site on private land?
Because he's not required to go where the government permits him to have his prayers. He's permitted to have his religious expression in public as the First Amendment permits him to do, and as the Supreme Court has encouraged him.
He's actually not allowed to do that, and the district has said that they will accommodate his private prayers, which they are required to do. They've said they can give him a private room. They've agreed to a lot of different things. He's the one that hasn't agreed to that.
Okay, I'm going to give the last word to our guest, Jeremy Dice, with the Texas-based Liberty Institute. Jeremy?
Look, the First Amendment affords every citizen in this country the right to be able to live, to learn, to do business according to their faith. It does not require them to hide their faith in public, and it certainly does not require employees to hide their faith while they are at work itself. The school district here can solve this whole thing. They have chosen not to do so, but instead to punish an individual because of his religious beliefs while at work. That's wrong, and they're going to have to answer to that in court.
Jeremy Dice, Texas-based Liberty Institute, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, the district would say, no, not because of his religious beliefs, but because of this prayer. Whether he's inviting students, whether does it feel coercive because you're a student or you're a cheerleader and you're at a school activity, all this will be decided apparently by a court because Liberty Institute has said they will defend his religious freedom.
There was a good question that came at me and KOW on social media. Has the Liberty Institute ever gone to court to defend the right of a Muslim to offer a prayer in a similar situation?
Well, he did talk about, I believe he said Orthodox Jews being kicked out of their homeowners association. He talked about the Native American Sweat Lodge, and I don't know anything about those cases. You're listening to The Week in Review on KOW. So, again, this in case you are just tuning in, this coach, Joe Kennedy, is on. He's not fired. He's on paid administrative leave as the Bremerton School District tries to work this out. By the way, who won the game? Was it Squim or Bremerton last night? I know everything about this
worked.
Except the score from
the
last night's
worked,
game.
I think Bremerton won, but check me on that. I think they did.
How could we possibly check something like that? We have someone who's on it. It's 10:54. We'll come right back and see whether Seattle's going to move or not. Stay tuned. Find the football game score, will you? KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Eli Sanders and Joni Balter and C.R. Douglas. And you, learning from the news of the week. Final topic this week as we head to the election. I'm not asking you whether we should vote for or against Move Seattle, but I am very curious about how, at least the way we talk about this. This is the $930 million levy, biggest Seattle levy in city history, right? We typically in Seattle pass levies. When we're asked, we say yes. But the zeitgeist seems to be that this is going down to the wire. Do we have any evidence of that? Have we seen polls?
Well, here's what we have. We have an earlier poll that showed this and, doing very well. You say traffic to Seattle and money and let's fix it. I mean, that sounds like a yes, right? But there's been a vigorous no campaign. And the way that the campaign for Move Seattle is conducting itself right now makes me feel that they know something we don't know, and that is that it's either very close or in a little bit of trouble. Because
why do you think that would be?
Because you don't go sort of down and dirty as they did yesterday. They went after the funder, Faye Garneau, who figures also in the district elections. That's sort of like what you do when you're really worried.
But why do you think it has?
Because there's been a lot of bad news that has broken against the mayor and this levy. In the last several weeks, there's been more reports about problems with current city projects. I mean, the seawall's over budget and behind schedule. The First Hill streetcar's over budget and behind schedule. The fire station upgrade program is over budget and behind schedule. So there's a question about whether, is this the right time to be giving the city a billion more dollars? Can they execute? Now, to be fair, those were all projects the mayor inherited. He didn't start them, but he's getting a lot of pushback for the accountability piece.
And also to that point, the earlier Bridging the Gap did not hit the numbers of street paving, was it, that it was supposed to do? So, there are numbers that are sort of getting into the way of people voting yes.
The Stranger endorsed Move Seattle, and basically the idea was, yes, there is some problem in this levy in terms of a lack of specifics about what is going to be funded. I think that is kind of endemic to this type of levy. It's hard to be super specific, but we think the overall good of working on the transportation mess in Seattle outweighs those concerns. I do think what you may be seeing here, if in fact this levy is in trouble, is finally that thing that we always kind of predict but never comes true, which is levy fatigue. There are multiple levies on the ballot this year that go straight to the property tax. Year after year, we've been going to the property tax to solve all our problems, and there might be something about this biggest levy in history connected to the property tax at this time of concern about housing costs anyway that tips the balance against it.
So last year, we were offered a Metropolitan Park District. In other words, let's open the spigot of money for parks. This year, this is limited by 9 years, but it's still open the spigot for transportation. Next year, they'll hit you for housing and police, perhaps. So it's a lot of spigots of money, if you think about it, at a time when the city's pretty flush.
I mean, one problem for the mayor and other supporters, if it does go down, you know, the assumption is they'll come back with a smaller package next year. But they have a window here that's going to close because next year everyone's expecting and will be pushing a housing levy that'll probably be in the $300 million range. Sound Transit will be on the ballot for $15 billion. There's not really a chance to come back with another $1 billion or even $500 million levy that's for sure next year because there's a lot of other things in the queue.
I'll take that bet that they're back if they lose.
And just quickly on the question of levy fatigue, people will point out, especially Move Seattle people, that Seattle, compared to other cities, is not overly burdened by its property tax, even though we keep going back to it. There are cities where the property tax burden is much higher, comparable large cities.
Move Seattle or not, we're going to know, maybe, unless it's down to the wire, we're going to know next week.
Indeed.
Final words? Let me just say a final word. Thank you for coming, Eli Sanders.
Thank you.
At The Stranger. Do you have a book you want to plug?
I do. I have a book coming out in February. It's called While the City Slept. You can find it online, and you could pre-order it from Amazon or an independent bookseller just with that title, While the City Slept.
That's a great title for that book. Wonderful. Congratulations.
Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. Thanks.
Thank you.
C.R. Douglas analyzes politics at Q13 Fox, but he doesn't stop there. He comes to KUOW. Thank you.
But I have no book.
You'll get one. Bernard Ouellette, Jason Pagano, Bremerton Beat Squim. Thanks for joining us.